We started off with trying to figure out what a theory was. We said it was a body of concepts and the interrelations among the concepts with the purpose of explanation and prediction and guidance, guidance in developing vision or strategy. We mentioned examples of some theories. We discussed the components in the sense of a concept, which is to say a slice of reality. We pointed out how basically you can slice up reality any way you want, odd or sensible, peculiar kinds of concepts. And we tried to develop what was the criteria that you used for carving up reality into concepts, and it depended upon what the domain of concern of your theory was and what your purpose in doing the theory was. And in our case, the purpose being social change to make things better, we want to carve up concepts out of the totality of all the stuff out there that bear upon our priorities, understanding the world in order to change it. Then we looked at examples of concepts and so on, and we looked at these existing radical theories that we might just adopt, that somebody in here could say, well, instead of developing a new one, I'm going to adopt one of these long-standing, well-established ones. So we looked a bit at the concepts that were associated with Marxism, anarchism, feminism, and nationalism. And when we listed those out pretty spontaneously, we found, oddly enough, that while each set of concepts made good sense in the rubric that it was addressing, they didn't overlap very much, even though they were ostensibly about the same thing, the world and how to make it a better place. Then we began to develop our own concepts. We started off with people, but a broader understanding of people than is typical of left social theory, emphasizing needs, aspirations, desires, consciousness, skills, not everything about people, but a lot. And then we came across the idea of institutions and the institutional framework or the system or the institutional boundary that people relate to, the roles that compose and define institutions. Now, we gave a lot of examples of that, trying to understand what those were, starting from scratch. We decided that we needed to focus in on certain, not just institutions, but types of institutions, and we came up with economy, polity, community, and kinship. And we realized after a while that while these were four different parts, in a sense, each was the whole thing, because every institution was in one of those four parts. But some institutions were centrally economic and peripherally kinship or community, and other institutions were centrally kinship or maybe polity and peripherally the other. But all of them had elements of each. So in a sense, each of these four spheres writ large is the whole society. Each of these four spheres honing in on the core aspects of it is separate from the other four or is different in its core features. And then we began to address related issues, and which leaves us now at the problem of, okay, we've got these concepts. How do we move forward to have a picture of what a society is? After all, that's what we're talking about, societies. And of history. How does history work? So society is clearly this dynamic entity that includes people and institutions that changes over time, but it's basically stable. Every so often, there's an instability. There's some kind of major defining change. We'll talk about that a lot in time. And the society has various components. And what a theory does is it hones you in on some of those aspects as being central, and it gives you tools with which to think about them and how they interact and interrelate, which is a lot of what we're going to talk about this time. But just to continue for a minute the review, when the Marxists look at the society, what are the components that they feel are central? Somebody? Promptly? Economics and
class
and mode of production and corporations, basically the stuff that we had as concepts coming out of that thing that we call the economic sphere. Remember, we said that these spheres they exist because people are people, and because people being people need an economic dimension, a political dimension, a cultural dimension, and a kinship dimension. You can't have societies without these things. To solve the associated functions, production, consumption, and allocation, economics, legislation, execution of law, adjudication, polity, cultural identification, community, nurturance, socialization, procreation, kinship. To solve these functions that have to be solved in a society, people group together into institutions, things like the family, the corporation, or in other times, you know, the feudal realm or whatever, right? Various institutions that accomplish these functions. So a society is a center of people with their various levels of fulfillment divided how? How are they divided up, the people in such a society, from our point of view? We could say they're divided up into everybody over 5 feet and under 5 feet. Do we do that? No. Why? Because it's useless from our point of view. What did I do? I just broke this pen that I bought an hour ago. I must not be too hyper.
So maybe economics and gender would be useful from our point of view?
Okay, and but what we said these spheres exist. Right? Now, what makes these spheres critical from our point of view is that people relate to the roles in them, and in the institutions, and those institutional roles do what? They define various tasks that we have to do as part of our lives. So, to be in the economy, we must fill some kind of economic role. We must be a worker or a manager or an owner, and then one a specific type, right? Whatever it might be. And in carrying out the functions and the tasks and the responsibilities that are associated with this role, our days are largely filled in that institution. And it has an impact on us, on what our interests are. I don't mean by interests what we are interested in. I mean by our interests, our desires, our needs, but what we pursue. In other words, higher wages, isn't it, right? Or better working conditions, or more profit, or et so on. The kinship slots that we fill give us different perspective on the world, different roles, different things to do. We might be a father and spend 37 seconds with our kids, and we might be a mother totally interacting with them. We might have the various roles and responsibilities in these various positions. So these things impact us and impact our consciousness and our needs and our potentials. And then they divide us into constituencies. And the constituencies are typically classes, genders, cultural communities, which includes things like ethnic groups and races and religions, and body politic, the political elite and basically the electorate in our system, but in other systems, different things. And these constituencies dramatically impact our life prospects. If we know about somebody which constituencies they're in, we don't know with 100% accuracy anything. But with a high degree of accuracy, we know a whole lot. See, that's what's different about this in physics. If you know that something is an electron, you know everything, right? And you know it with 100% accuracy about that particle. With a person, if you know these things about them, that they're in such and such constituencies, you know a lot. You know a lot about their culture, you know a lot about their needs, you know a lot about their situation, you know a lot about the prospects in life, and so on. And that's really highly true. We'll do this a lot for class in the economics course. We'll see that what class you're in determines a lot, much more than people think. Like what they read and what they watch and what they eat and where they go and on and on and on. And same thing for race and same thing for gender. It has tremendous impact on our lives. So that being true, we not only see the center of people, we see the center of, like the Marxist sees the center of people and sees classes, right? And the feminist sees genders. Well, we see them all, right? I hope, right? That's what I'm aiming at anyway. We think that you should see them all. You should see all these sectors. Why? Well, because they're all, in my opinion, crucial to social change. And you can't just pick one, relate to that one, and accomplish the social change you want to accomplish. We'll see why as we go along. the Marxist sees the relationship among the conceptual components. How? The conceptual component base and superstructure. Somebody in here, how do they see the relationship between these two things? The economy and everything else, and the economy doing what? Impacting everything else. So the most mechanical Marxist will say that the economic dynamics in society, the manifestations, the sort of, consider it like a force field if you want, the force field that emanates out from the fact that you have private ownership and markets and capitalist institutions, or that you have Soviet institutions, right, or whatever you have in the economy, emanates out and impacts kinship, and it impacts culture, and it impacts the state, and it causes all those other institutions to basically, in their important features, reflect what the economy requires. That's what the Marxist framework is saying. And so you focus on the economy because it impacts all the rest, and when you change the economy, it changes all the rest. That's what the radical feminist is saying, right? Impact the kinship sphere, affect everything. impact the way people are socialized, nurtured, brought up, change the people, change everything. Right? That's broadly what the kind of argument is. Nationalists might say the same thing about impact culture and community relations, impact everything. Now, there's some truth to this, as we're going to see in a minute, but there's also some missing. So they each see the world with that kind of prioritization, right? And the more flexible they are, the more diverse their view of it is, but it's always that kind of prioritization. Okay, how do we understand the relationship between these different spheres? So let's just take two. Let's say kinship and the economy for our first example. We have kinship sphere and we have an economy. What we're saying is that the defining kinship institutions have profound impact on people's lives and on what people can be and on how they'll view the world and so on and so forth. And the defining economic institutions similarly have profound impact. And these put people into classes and these put people into genders. Now what can we say, just on the almost common sense, what can we say about the relationship between these two spheres in a society? What can we expect? They what?
There's similarities between.
Well, what kind of similarities? This one creates a hierarchy among classes. This one creates a hierarchy among genders, right? And this has roles which basically expect the hierarchy. And this has roles that expect the hierarchy. Now, in the abstract, taken outside of a society. Now, we plop them down both into a society, one society. What do we expect the economy to do with respect to genders? Well, how? What will the economy not do? And why would it be a problem? Suppose the economy pays women more than men.
But under my kinship group, if the gender roles is that male are...
Right. Suppose this is sexist in a normal way.
If the economy pays women more, that's going to flip the roles in the economic sphere, which is going to cause tension in the family sphere, and you're going to have this...
Clash. There's some kind of a strange... If over here, the expectations and the consciousness and everything else is consistent with the idea of male domination, right? And male prerogative as compared to female. And over here, the economy says, well, we don't care about that. We're just going to pay the way it turns out. And it happens to turn out that women are going to get more or even equal, right? Then over here, there's a problem, right? Now, what happens... What can we say about what's likely to happen in the family with regard to things that are economic? And what do I have in mind here?
Would undermine the male leadership, because if the wife's bringing home more money than the husband, we're going to start...
But that's the one we just did. Let's reverse it. What I want to know is, what is it about the economy that has to be respected by the family? A little harder, but not too much. What does the economy expect? Just like the family has a hierarchy among genders, what does the economy have? A class hierarchy, right? So you can't have this, the cultural sphere, and the kinship sphere, doing what? You can't have it socializing people to fill the working slot and giving them what? Giving them what?
Exactly.
Well, they don't pay them over here in the kinship sphere. What does the kinship sphere do? It socializes, it educates, it, you know? So what does it have to do?
Socialize them.
Yeah, it better. What happens if what it does is it makes everybody expect in life, you know, a fulfilling set of circumstances in which they're self-managing? Well, then they come over here in the economy, and what happens? They don't. Well, what happens? Tension, right? And there's going to be change. Let me give you an example of this. The Carnegie Commission report was done in the early 1970s. It's not exactly what we're doing, but it's perfect. They were commissioned by the government to study education. So they went off and studied the educational system, and they came back with their report. And the report was, our education system over-educates the population. No lie. I mean, if you have to think carefully about what could the concept over-educating the population even be, right? I mean, but it is something. What they said is, what's happening is our education system is giving people expectations which our economy won't meet, right? And we have a big problem. And they thought this was the source of the 60s. And it was one of the components of the sources of the 60s. That people were coming into the economy with false expectations, too high expectations, which were dashed, and they were getting pissed. right? What you need to do instead, said the Carnegie Commission report, is change around the educational system. Diminish the number of four-year colleges, increase the number of vocational schools. Diminish the number of people who in public schools actually get educated, increase the number of people in public schools who get dumbed down, right? For whom public school imposes basically a deadening climate in which they learn how to be bored, and how to endure boredom, and to take orders. Anybody here been in public school? That's what you learn in public school, right? That is what you learn in public school. That is the key thing to learn in public school. How to endure boredom. You're watching the clock at the end of the day, but you sit there. That's enduring boredom, right? Getting a human being to do that is quite a stunt. It takes them about 12 years to get people to be no longer human and to just endure boredom with no response whatsoever other than being bored, right? And obey orders. Which is worse, to get a C or to disobey? And which do you go to the principal for? Right? It's clear what the priorities are, if you think about it a little while. So the point is here, what I'm trying to say is...
We're not really here.
Okay. What I'm trying to say is, if you have these various spheres of social life, and if they have these profound impacts for people, you can't have one sphere producing people that fits over where they are, but that don't fit elsewhere. That's the way societies work. There are these role slots. People have to fit. If you've got a misfit, something has to change, either the people or the institutions. That's why center boundary. The idea here being that this center of people and this boundary of institutions, they got to come together. If they don't, you have a tension and you get a change. We're going to see how change happens and how history moves and stuff. But, so the point is, obviously the economy is going to reproduce, and anybody who studies the economy emphasizes this, it's going to reproduce the conditions of the economy. So, the dynamics of the workplace are not going to make workers want more and more. They're not going to make workers think that they are entitled to more and more power. They're not going to give workers more and more knowledge and more skills which they can utilize to take a bigger and bigger piece of share of the output. They're going to do the exact opposite on every count. They're going to reproduce the hierarchy of the economy, right? And over here in the kinship sphere, however it works, and I think it has a lot to do with, I mentioned, men fathering and women mothering, but however it works, the kinship sphere is going to reproduce the hierarchical relations among men and women. It isn't going to upset them. But what's interesting is, it's also going to have to be the case, and this is why the Marxists can explain a lot about other spheres, they're going to have to come into some kind of accord. You can't have the economy paying men more and have stability. There will be conflict then. Something will change, right? Maybe the kinship sphere will push the economy back into line, or maybe the economy will move the kinship sphere. You see what I'm saying? If the hierarchies are out of whack, if people's expectations are off, and this happens a lot. What's an example? Does anybody know the origins of, in many people's minds, of the civil rights movement in the United States? You know, the impetus that led to the civil rights movement.
Black returning from World War II.
Yeah, so there's an example, and it's partly true. It's not completely true, but it's a considerable part true. The dynamics of World War II were such that they just damn well wanted people who could fight and who could be in the army and who could do a good job. And there was a good deal of colorblindness. And as a result, the blacks who went into the army in World War II found themselves in situations which were, in fact, much less racist than they had come from. Not perfect by any means, but a whole far cry from what they were used to. And expectations were set up. Expectations about being treated like a full human being. And when they went back, the expectations were dashed and resistance resulted. But that's an example of, an important institution, not a very long-lasting one, the war, right, and the army in this case, creating a dynamic which was contrary to dynamics in the rest of society and leading to a clash, leading to a social movement. And that's an example of this kind of thing. Now, what you'd expect in a stable society, in a society that's rolling along smoothly, as elites want it to do, you expect not to find that. You expect to find the institutions in the various spheres of social life functioning somehow at least a little bit in accord. Now, this is what, remember I said in the thing I developed, I mentioned Marxist feminists. Understanding, you know, coming up with two things. So they began to see this. But some people saw something more. Let's call this accommodation for a minute. So that's another concept we have, and that's a name for the situation of the implications for people, the role implications, and the different spheres coming into at least accord with each other, not contradicting each other. one sphere not creating a dynamic among its populace such that it over, you know, it contradicts the workings of the other sphere. Is this all clear? Okay. So we'll call that accommodation. Now, is that the most that can happen? What that means, again, is that in the economy, the easiest place to see a lot of these things is the economy, and that's just because there's been more attention to it in many ways. And so we know more about it, and I happen to know more about it. So it's easier to give examples, but try not to let me do it all the time. But in any case, in the economy, it means exactly what we said. You're not going to pay blacks more than whites. If you do in the U.S. economy, you're out of whack with the cultural community. So even if you're a black owner, when you hire your workforce, you're not going to do that, right? All the market pressures are away from it. But suppose we had a colorblind society that wasn't racist. Racism is not produced by capitalism, contrary to what many people think. Capitalism does not give a shit what people's race is. It doesn't care what people's gender is, intrinsically. There's nothing in it that intrinsically differentiates between men and women, or between black and whites. It only does that because there's a power imbalance between those constituencies that's emerged from some other dynamics. From the capitalist point of view, it is literally the case, and there is even a certain pressure in this direction, that it wants people who they can make the most profit from, and it doesn't give a damn what they are, right? But on the other hand, if you can make more profit from a certain sector of people, or if you will face more conflicts. So suppose for a minute that, suppose you're, I don't remember your real name, but I'll call you Jesse. What's your name?
Jason.
Jason, suppose you're you own a small workplace, right? And you've got a white workforce, and a black guy and a white guy apply to be a manager. We'll use a guy for the moment. Which one do you hire?
Just on the criteria of whether they're black or white.
Well, let's say the black guy has more qualifications and is smarter and more clever and even a better at manipulating and keeping down the rabble.
Then I would hire the black guy.
Anybody think you wouldn't? Why might you not?
Because
what?
Because your workforce is white.
And so what's the problem?
That you're going to have, your workforce is going to be mighty upset if we're going by what constant, you know.
With our society.
We're going with our society.
Well, it is.
Mighty upset with having a black manager.
Their expectations are that blacks are in what position?
In a position of
subordinate. Subordinate. Not, suppose you got a black workforce. Now, if you hire a white, you're hiring somebody that is in accord with the hierarchy over here in the community sphere. If you hire a black, you're not accomplishing anything. If you have a white workforce and you hire a white, you're not really accomplishing anything one way or the other. But if you hire a black, you're hiring somebody who, in this community sphere, the expectation is the opposite. You're just making problems for yourself. People don't do it. It isn't because they're malicious necessarily. Now, most of the time they become malicious, but you don't have to be malicious to act this way. You just are functioning inside of a market context, inside of an economic context in which there are various pressures at work. And you do the thing that makes sense inside that context. And you don't have to be a thug to do it. That's the crucial thing to understand, that it's institutional pressures that yield the results. Put good people in there, and you get bad outcomes. All right, so accommodation is what I'm describing, right? Is there something more that we could imagine in the relationship between these spheres of social life? Some kind of greater interactivity? This is a hard question. Well, what do you mean?
Well, in the sense that they don't just accommodate each other, they actually work off of and support each other and make each part greater through the workings of the other part.
Okay, right. Now, what does it mean? That is a step more. In other words, one step is they just don't cause each other problems, right? So each sphere doesn't do something that is contrary to the logic and the dictates and the mechanisms of the other. The greater thing would be each sphere does something which actually advances and perpetuates the dynamics of the others, right? Well, remember I said before that we might have to go back and look at the concepts that were in the box because there was going to be this interactivity? Let's think about that for a minute. Suppose you really were a real, real strong radical feminist and you have no economic concepts and you look at a workplace, what would you see?
Gender imbalance.
You'd see gender imbalance. Yes, and you might see that in any event, because that's pretty obvious in the workplace, probably. But what more might you see? What are your concepts?
Sexism.
You'd see sexism.
Sexual harassment.
Huh?
Sexual harassment.
Sexual harassment, you'd see that, but what more?
Pay inequality.
Huh? Pay inequality, you'd see. All these things are going to be, are sort of okay with accommodation. They sort of go with that. But you might see something much more. You might, what do you see when you look in the family? You see all those things, but you see something else. You see the roles. And what are the roles? Mother, father, daughter, son, etc. What might you see when you look in the workplace?
Secretaries.
Well, you might actually see mother, fathers, daughters, and sons.
But I mean, subordinate as workers.
Yeah, but it's in the workplace. But what I'm trying to say, see, there's a woman named Batya Weinbaum. She did this. She's the first who ever did it, I think, and one of the only ones who ever did it, but I think it makes strong sense. It's like Marxist looking at the family and seeing little class. In fact, you can read Mao doing that, describing families as little class structures, right? And so the father is the capitalist, and the mother is the manager, and the kid is the worker or something. And that's what happens when you have class concepts and nothing else. Well, but you do see something when you do that. You know, you do see something that really is there. Well, what Batya did is she looked at the workplace and she said, let's look at this thing from a real gender point of view. Let's just skip the economic concepts that we had and really look at this from a gender point of view and see if we can see something close to the kinds of dynamics that you see in families. Behavior and beliefs and patterns of behavior and assumptions that are like those that you see in the... And she found it. It's worth reading, although it's probably out of print. Women in Revolution... I'll think of it. Anyway, so she literally saw in the workplace men and women engage. I mean, you can. Here's an example of it. The role secretary is a job. You could imagine it having a bunch of tasks because that's what it is. It's a role with a bunch of tasks. If there's no sexism, right, the tasks that it includes are not likely to include various kinds of nurturing and supportive tasks that are rather similar to the role of the woman over in the family. But an accommodation won't bring those in either. Accommodation is just going to make sure that if a woman fills the role, she's paid less, right? But co-reproduction is what I want to call it, another concept. You used the word harmony, I'm going to use this word. Co-reproduction is a situation in which the economy is, in a sense, not just not contradicting the kinship sphere, but the field of force, if you will, that emanates from the kinship sphere remolds the economy, right? So the basic economic dynamics now are not just economic, but they incorporate various kinds of kinship logic or gender logic. And so the job definitions incorporate sexism and the reproduction of sexism. And you can imagine the reverse, right? And you can do the same thing. We'll do it in a second. For say, race, the same exact idea. There's the community sphere and, say, the government or the polity or the kinship or the economy. It doesn't matter. And accommodation is just that these other spheres don't elevate blacks above whites in the United States or Latinos above whites or whatever the hierarchy happens to be. But co-reproduction is that the culture of these other institutions inside the workplace becomes dominant culture, white culture. And the assumptions begin to reproduce those racial relations. Now here comes an ironic point. Suppose you're a real radical feminist. What do you think about the power of the kinship sphere? But you think the kinship sphere is very, very powerful, right? It's like a real Marxist, or a real orthodox Marxist, right? So the Marxist says economy, everything else. Economy manifests influences and everything else comes into accord, right? So we're saying something like that. We're saying each sphere manifests influences, right? The others have to accommodate, and they may co-reproduce. So the radical feminist says, who's a real strong radical feminist, says, or that's their belief, right? Her belief. She says the kinship sphere emanates this powerful, powerful force which affects everything else profoundly. Now look, what does that tell us about... What does that tell us the economy is going to do? Is it going to just accommodate sexism? It certainly will accommodate sexism, right? But it'll reinforce. It's the kinship sphere is so powerful. This is what the radical feminist is saying. The kinship sphere is so powerful that the economy is going to be impacted by it, and its role definitions are going to be altered, right? What it means to be various slots inside the economy is going to start to incorporate gender logic, right? Until the economy starts to reproduce sexism. Now, notice something very interesting here happens. The radical feminist says to change the world and get rid of sexism, forget about getting rid of anything else, to get rid of sexism, we have to change the kinship sphere. Is this person being consistent or inconsistent? What's the problem with what the person's saying?
Well, the
economics. Go ahead.
It's inconsistent because if the logic is that it's so powerful that it's going to affect the economy and everything else, then logically you would have to change the economy.
Yeah, it's a wonderful irony, or a wonderful, you know, conundrum, or whatever you want. That the more the radical feminist is right, the more the Marxist, the orthodox Marxist is right, the more the nationalist is right, the more the anarchist is right in our way of viewing the world, the more they're wrong. Because the more they're right, the more their sphere, the sphere that they hone in on and they emphasize, is powerful and emanates this influence, right, which in turn causes the others to be redefined in elements so that they are reproducing the same hierarchy. But if that's the case, if you just change this first one, you just change the kinship sphere in this example, but you leave the economy, the polity, and the culture, the economy, the polity, and the culture are all still reproducing sexism. Forget about it, in fact, getting anything else. And all you've done now is you've eliminated maybe this distant past soul source, but now you've only eliminated, so you've still got sexism being reproduced over here over and over and over again. And you've got this, you see what I'm saying? Now this is very important because now this makes this overwhelming argument that the more you think one of the spheres is important, strangely enough, the more important it is to pay attention to all four of them. If you don't think one is important, well then there's another good reason to pay attention to all four of them. Yeah.
I'm wondering why the logic wouldn't be, say, of the radical. Why the logic of the radical feminist or the orthodox Marxist wouldn't be, since there is a base from which the hierarchy emanates and goes into the other spheres. If you change that base, why wouldn't that change also?
That is their logic. In other words, they do say there's these sets of institutions, the core institutions of kinship or the economy, whatever it is, depending upon, right? And those things are profound and powerful, and when you change them, everything changes. But there's an inconsistency in their thinking, I think. Now, I'm saying from our point, from that, they can cling to the view if they want. I'm saying from our point of view, it seems like from our understanding of how these spheres interact, that the stronger one of them is, the more it will be the case that its dynamics and its logic are being reproduced all over society. Right? And so that whatever it was one time in the distant past, now things have matured and altered and changed, and all of them are reproducing it. Right? So the economy is reproducing sexism continuously. And you can't just change the... Now you can, you know, you could just change the family and hope that everything changes. But it could be that your change will be overwhelmed by everything else, and it'll just go back. Right? We've seen this kind of dynamic in history, right? Yeah.
You also said that capitalism is not intrinsically sexist.
Yeah.
So if it's not intrinsically sexist, wouldn't changing the socialization of the gender sphere?
It's not. But what I mean when I say capitalism isn't intrinsically sexist is that capital. Well, you answer me this. Do you think you could have capitalism in a planet where there's only one sex?
Yeah.
Of course you could. Right? Of course you could have capitalism on a planet where there's only one sex. So we've already, lots of questions, you can make them infinitely hard. Somebody could write a 500-page book on whether capitalism is intrinsically sexist, right? To me, it takes two sentences. Now, maybe that's because I'm stupid and I can't get to all the subtleties, right? But to me, saying capitalism is intrinsically sexist is saying capitalism requires, right? Capitalism imposes, capitalism makes it the case, regardless of anything else, right, that there will be a hierarchy between men and women. Well, it's obviously not true. Right? There's nothing gendered about capitalism. And it's basic. What makes it gendered is that it's in a society in which there's a gendered sphere, right? And that gendered sphere imposes by its sort of field of force, if you will, on it, and makes it accommodate or maybe co-reproduce.
Right.
Once it is co-reproducing, and once it is accommodating, right? Just because abstract capitalism isn't sexist, our capitalism is sexist. Capitalism as we know it in the United States is sexist because it has incorporated those changes. We don't have abstract capitalism. Nobody does. Nobody ever has abstract anything. We don't have abstract patriarchy either. Or if there was a name for the particular kind of patriarchy in the United States, it wouldn't be the abstract, pure, pristine version of that. It would be the version of that that develops in accord with a country that has racism the way we have racism, and so on and so forth. You see what I'm saying? Yeah.
When you look at these interrelationships, then how do you look at the fact that you have the largest black middle class, and then you have also an expanding underclass? If you're looking at the interrelationships, because you got an expanding black middle class,
yeah,
also expanding underclass at the same time.
What I'm describing is a system that is operating exactly as elites want it, elites from these four sectors. We don't live in that system either. We live in a system that just had, you know, a gigantic civil rights movement, right, which won a lot. And my answer to you is that we won that. That wasn't natural. We won that. And we won that racism is a lot less now in many, many, many respects than it was 30 years ago. Profoundly less. I mean, a lot of people, you know, especially young people run around and say we never win anything, it's all worse than it ever was. They just have no idea what they're talking about, right? Jim Crow is not what we live under right now. And ask any black person in the South whether there's more or less racism, whether life is better or worse. I mean, you know, it's not an issue. But that's because we want it, not because the institutions, right? So you have two things going on. You have the normal logic or the unfolding of the dynamics of the institutions, which is what we were talking about. And then you have the fact that people can fight and can win other things. And can win things that make things better, obviously. Now, the gains of the civil rights movement have been skewed in many ways into a form which is consistent with and not disruptive of, especially class relations, right, and gender relations, and that's why it takes the form that you describe, and even race relations to an extent, because there's a degree to which white people are capable of not minding that Reggie Miller makes a lot of money, or Michael Jordan. And they see almost all blacks with wealth as being somehow like them, right? They're somehow athletes. They're somehow making it off something other. You know what I mean? So they get away with it. It doesn't quite disrupt the whole thing. It's not physics. Nothing that I just... If you make any of this, if you try to make it into physics, right, or math or something, it ain't going to work. It'll fall apart right and left and center. But so will any social theory, because people aren't electrons, right? It's more complicated, and there's more factors. But you're right, that's a crucial factor that I was leaving out. That what a society is at any given moment is those four spheres and is the people and everything else, but it's also affected by the fact that some people have said no. Some people are rebelling against the normal dynamics of the society and winning things, and maybe even winning big things, which is about what we're about to get to. Okay, so do we have a picture of society? So suppose I ask you to characterize South Africa 20 years ago, right? And you're a Marxist. What kind of society do you say it is? Come on. Huh? Capitalist. You say it's a capitalist society. Well, capitalist, because it was. What kind of society do you say it is if you're in the ANC? Apartheid. You say it's an apartheid society. So you're using different concepts, right? In other words, there's a tendency to define societies by the sphere that you take as paramount. What do we have to do? Oh, shit. We have to use a long string of phrases, right? Which is very annoying, but it's the way the cookie crumbles unless we come up with new words, right? We can't just say about the United States and South Africa they're both capitalist. Let's make it the United States, South Africa, and Sweden 20 years ago. They're all capitalist. It just doesn't work for us. Because the United States and South Africa, let's dump Sweden for a minute. The United States and South Africa are different, very different in their community sphere. Right? Very, very different. And they're so profoundly different that nationalists feel like, you know, the United States, the Soviet Union, and everything else is the same, and South Africa is different. Right? Because they look at that as the critical defining feature. So the point is, you can define societies in terms of one sphere, or you can define it in terms of many. And I think it makes sense, again, obviously, to define it in terms of many of them. Okay, what is... To start to get into change and history, what is a revolution? How do you define revolution? We all use that word all the time.
Fundamental change.
Yeah.
Radical change led by the people.
Radical change led by the people. Go ahead.
Change
some more.
The political sphere.
A what?
Change in the political sphere.
Change in the political sphere.
Change in.
This is a concept, isn't it? So actually, we can define this any old way we please.
Sure.
Although it might make it hard to communicate with other people, and it's going to, the way we're going to do it. suppose you're a Marxist. How do you define the word revolution? Well, no, you can have a revolution against feudalism. What's a revolution for a Marxist? So it's the change in the defining economic institutions. Let's go back again to those four spheres of life. What I want to say is, like the Marxist, like the feminist, like the nationalist, like the anarchist, I want to hone in on what matters, right? So I want to say that in each of those spheres of life, there are some defining institutions which create the defining logic, the key logic that I care about, that is, the key logic of that hierarchy between those various constituencies, right? So the key logic of sexism, racism, authoritarianism, and ethnocentrism and nationalism also, and classism or whatever, depending upon the system that you're in, right? So the Marxist says, if you change the institutions that are defining the economy, and then they go further and say that's the ownership relations. But in any case, if you change the institutions that are defining the economic logic, that's a revolution. What does an anarchist say?
Change the governmental system.
Yeah. I mean, basically, they might fudge, but basically they say if you change the state, it's a revolution. Now, was there a revolution in South Africa when they got rid of apartheid? What's a Marxist say?
No.
No. And what's an anarchist say?
Yes.
No. I've never heard an anarchist say that that was a revolution. And I don't think they should, with their logic. Right? Because it didn't change the state. The state was... It changed who occupied positions in the state, up to a point, but it didn't change the state. Did any feminist call the change from apartheid to not apartheid a revolution? You think Nelson Mandela thought it was a revolution?
Yeah.
Damn well better believe it did. And he's right, and they're wrong, I think. But why? In our framework, right? In our framework, well, let's just go on and see. Suppose we say, in the United States, well, I don't know. In the Soviet Union, what happened recently in the change? Was that a revolution? See, it depends who you ask again. Right? But for us, it was certainly an economic revolution from an economic system that we'll call in other classes a coordinatorist system, but if you want to call it socialism, call it socialism, I don't care. Whatever you call it, it was the old Soviet-style economy, and then it changed into a capitalist economy. That was a basic defining change in the sphere. Am I defining it in terms of people winning a battle? No, it could involve people winning a battle, but I'm not defining it that way. I'm saying you have a revolution in a society when the defining institutions, when the defining logic of at least one sphere of social change, of social life changes. I could define it differently. I could say you got to change all four to be a revolution. I could define it that way. We'll call that revolution with a, you know, with two R's. I can't even pronounce revolution. And then there's revolution with one R, right? And so we have two different concepts. So I could use the revolution concept to be a change in all four if I wanted to. But I think it's sort of misleading, so I don't even bother with that concept, but that's what you really want, right? But a revolution is a change in any one of the defining things. Okay, now history. What is history? Why don't things just sit tight? Why doesn't everything just... Well, I'll give you an example. Actually, it was my mother's 85th birthday, and we took her to Egypt. For a trip, and we went on the Nile, and we saw Egypt, and we saw the first time I've been out of the country in like 25 years, and only once or twice other than that. But this was a big trip, and it was really remarkable. But one thing, we saw the pyramids and everything else, and for all the other stuff about that, that's amazing. And let me tell you, it is amazing. I mean, I didn't expect a, gift to my mother, but I was blown away. But you see this wall stuff, which is everywhere. I mean, the stuff's everywhere. It's not like what you think on TV. You know, there's three pyramids and that's the end of it. It's a whole civilization. It's all there. It's underground. You dig up in your backyard, this Egypt. really. And it happens all the time that people are out in their backyards digging and, there's stuff under there. So because it was huge cities, gargantuan stuff. Anyway, there's all this stuff on the wall, and so you can see their culture. And so you're looking at something that's 3,000, well, it's 4,000 years ago, even 5,000 years ago. And then you look at something that's 2,000 years ago. That's 3,000 years difference, right? 3,000 years, right? And it's the same. The same. It's the same gods, the same stories, the same culture, the same technology, the same structure, the same government. Everything is the fucking the same. 3,000 years. This was mind-boggling to me. I mean, I studied a lot of Marxism, but I never understood until I saw that. The stuff in Marxism that, I mean, never really understood it in my gut. There's a lot in Marxism about capitalism being a dynamic system that leads to change and growth and development and stuff. And here I finally understood what the hell he was talking about. And science, too, as being a growth-oriented phenomenon that pushes forward and change and stuff. This thing was static forever. So the question is, why isn't everything static forever? Sort of an interesting question. In other words, why aren't there societies? And if the spheres are designed with a certain logic, and if each one is at least accommodating the rest and co-reproducing the rest, why doesn't the thing just go year after year after year without any changes? Where does any change come from?
Technology does.
Okay, so one good answer, one possible answer is technology. That something provokes people to exercise their brain cells and come up with innovative new technologies, which then in turn impact things. We'll see why anything should cause change more closely in a minute, but that's a good answer, and that's true. Yeah, which is why science is such a powerful pusher of various kinds of change. Yeah.
Natural phenomenon, massive.
Yeah, that could do it. You know, in other words, and it certainly has a big thing to do with natural evolution and stuff like that. But big, massive. You know, storms like this that get bigger. Yeah. And that disrupt and cause people to change around things, yeah. But not very much, because of 3,000 years, they probably had their share of storms. So we know from that evidence that didn't do much. What else? Well, what?
Language? Development?
That was there 3,000 years ago.
Literacy?
That was there for elites. But... Okay, why would literacy among lots of people be a factor? Maybe.
People communicate.
And do what?
Learn from each other.
And?
Innovate.
And?
Change.
Record history.
And decide we don't like it. See, there's a certain sector of people for whom it's perfectly okay for everything. Like, did the pharaoh want to change the pharaonic system?
No.
No way, right? And neither did anybody who could read for the pharaoh. But you're right, if everybody can read and everybody wants to change. The first strike, we were at the site of the first strike, I think it was 1100 BC. The strike happened because the people who made the pyramids and did all the work and stuff, you know, they would give them, it was sort of like Marxist in the sense that they would give them subsistence existence. Well, they decided that they'd experiment with giving them nothing. And they discovered that was a little bit, didn't work, even under this system. It was a little too much, and so there was a strike. Apparently that was the first strike. Notice, the reason why you don't give nothing, this will come out much more when the venomous discussion of capitalism occurs in the economics, but the reason you don't give nothing is not because people would die, but because people would stop working and resist. If you could get away with it, you would do it. If you were a capitalist. All right, so history. We've got these four spheres. I described the civil rights movement's emergence. What did I say there? How did I describe what was happening and why it led to possible big changes?
Because they had expectations.
And why did it come about? So it was dynamics that weren't in the community sphere, right? It was the normal operations of another sphere somehow tossed up results, right, which called into question the normal working of the community sphere. Now, you can imagine this happening in a lot of ways. For instance, give me an example of a technology which had a big impact on kinship.
Computers.
What'd you say?
I said computers, but I like that answer better.
Birth control. That's... better still. So the invention of birth control, just a technological invention, not come up with for any ideological reasons at all, right? The natural dynamics of other spheres of life turns out to create new possibility situations and existences and so on and so forth, which throw a damper in the normal operations of the kinship sphere up until that time. And you can imagine other instances of this, like literacy increasing, or, you know, maybe the computer. I mean, some people think that the computer, maybe we should talk about this at some point, but some people think that the computer is this technology which comes along, and because of its profit-making capacity, is pursued in the economy, right? But it's like an Achilles heel. You know, it's our Trojan horse or something. It's going to, while they're pursuing it for profit, they're giving us the tool that we're going to use to wreck them, right? I wish it was true. Not that it isn't a tool you can use. I certainly spend a lot of time using it, but it's not that good. All right, anyway, so one dynamic is that one sphere or another, spheres can get out of whack with each other, right? And by virtue of getting out of whack with each other, no longer accommodating, no longer co-reproducing, but instead doing the thing that the logic of social stability says they shouldn't do, but it does happen, right? Contradict one another, create conditions which undermine the workings of one. So this is another reason why if your personal focus happens to be on one sphere, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have eyes for the rest of the society. If your personal focus is on race and you don't understand what's going on over there in the army, you're taken by surprise by the civil rights movement. But if you do, you might be able to better prepare. So for example, so it makes sense to understand what's going on throughout the society, even with a narrow focus, a narrow agenda, not focus. Wide focus, even if you have a narrow agenda. So one way is that the different spheres of social life can come out of accord with each other. Another way is that you could have technologies that come along which cause dynamics. Another way is that what do the Marxists say is going on inside the economy? What do they describe?
Contradiction.
And why? Because what?
Just the natural workings of the system is contradictory in various aspects.
Okay, there's two things they say. One, I want to get two different kinds of contradictions. One kind of contradiction involves people, which is between... Okay, so one thing that they say is that which is right, that classes are defined by the economic roles, and the interests, that is, the agendas of the classes, are at odds with each other. Right? For capitalists to get ahead, workers get smushed, and for workers to get ahead, capitalists get smushed, at least up to a point, right? And then they don't pay much attention to this middle group, which it turns out for them to get ahead, both get smushed or not, right? The middle group being managers and intellectual workers. Which actually I think Marxism represents. But in any case, classes in conflict. Well, if classes are in conflict, that means that they're trying to change things. So another possible motor, if you want, of change is the constituencies assessing their situation and deciding that they want to change the world. That's very different than the sort of accidental dynamics of the system causing something, right? That's literally people taking control over their own lives, consciously understanding things and deciding to act. We are, after all, not just cogs pushed and pulled by past decisions and institutions. We have wills, and we can decide to do that. So that's a very important motive force, right? The economist, the Marxists say something else. What's the other thing they say?
Just that the system...
Yeah, that's the part that's bullshit. At least the collapse part. The idea here is that the normal operations of capitalism sort of throw up problems for capitalism itself. Now, one kind of problem that's thrown up is the growing working class and the possibility that that class will decide to change the world. That's true, but it requires will and organization. The other possibility is that the system itself sort of runs along and crashes. It just crumbles, right? Which capitalism can do, right? You can have a depression. You can have the thing literally unravel of its own accord. But you can also protect against that when you get smarter about it and you begin to understand it as they have, and you can take advantage of it. You're all familiar with the stuff that happened in East Asia when Thailand collapsed and whatever, all the other countries, Korea, Korean economy collapsed, I guess the Philippines... I don't even know all of them. A bunch of them collapsed, right? What was the result of that?
The West picked up some bargains.
Very astute. How do you know that? That is not supposed to be the first answer anybody gives. What? What made you say that?
That's the way I see it.
Yeah, well, you're pretty sharp. Because most economists don't know it. Very few people realize what actually happened. The first natural answer is some turmoil. Now, some turmoil in this case happens to mean millions of people fucked over. People starving, dying, etc. This was a calamity. This was a horror. Except, of course, it was over there in the world where it's non-white, and so it doesn't get portrayed quite as dramatically as it deserved to be portrayed. But in addition to that, what happened was, this is a sidebar, but it's very interesting and worth knowing. It's like colonialism was a process whereby, you know, the big empire countries send out their armies to India or whatever, right? And they fight battles, and they take over the economy, and they take the exploits of the economy. Well, this time around, they just sent a couple of folks, right, in a nice cruise first-class plane with a pen, right? And what they do, after the economy collapses and the prices all drop, they bought it all, right? And they just, at rock-bottom prices. And what happened was, 30 years since World War II to now, 30 years of independent development in a lot of these countries, not the millennium, not the perfect economy, not a participatory economy, but at least under, to a degree, the auspices of the people in those countries, right, changed hands to the West. A huge amount of infrastructure of, say, Korea and various countries, Thailand and so on and so forth, just changed hands to Western multinationals as a result of this massive collapse, which may tell you something about the dynamics of the collapse and whether or not it was really a horror or a good thing. But you notice the change in, from, it's the collapse isn't the end of the system, right? It's just an opportunity for the people who really are in power to change things around. But it does make change, that's true. Okay, so the big factor, of course, for historical change, I guess, is the possibility that the constituencies within any of these four spheres might embark on a program trying to create change. Do you want what? What's up? Oh, I don't know where it is.
Upstairs.
Up the stairs. And
okay. Okay. Anybody got any questions? Does any of this make any sense?
Yeah.
People think of it. Right. Is there a strong, yeah?
I was wondering if the Asian financial crisis also opened doors for many institutions like the IMF to come in.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, but see, the IMF, ultimately, again, institutions aren't people. Ultimately, institutions, they sometimes have dynamics of their own that transcend people. Let me give you another example of that. If you took the United States at the end of World War II, and you said, let's have the exact same per capita output, productivity, that we had then, now, right? However we distribute it, you understand what I'm saying? In other words, at the end of World War II, let's say 1950, there's a certain per capita output due to the technology level, due to the pace that people are working, et cetera, right? And it's distributed in a skewed way among the population as income. Are you with me? If we said, let's have the same total output, right, now, how much work do you think we'd have to do?
More than twice.
Yeah.
Well, what's happened between then and now that would affect how much work we'd have to do to get the same output?
Technological advances.
There's been a lot of technological innovation. Presumably, those technological innovations increase the productivity from our labors. So it should be that we have to work less. How much less? Roughly half. So now there's an interesting question to raise. And you can think about this for when we do the economics course. How come that isn't an issue? In other words, how come there's no conscious choice by anybody to say we'd rather work a 20-hour week with the total per capita output of 1950 instead of, it's actually 55 or 60. So we'd rather work a 25 or 30-hour week with the total per capita output of 1950 instead of working 60 hours with our current per capita output. Has any of you ever encountered anything that resembles, anything that remotely has to do with that decision? But this is a monumental decision. You could be working one month on, 1 month off, right? 1 week on, 1 week off, a year on, a year off, or a 30-hour week, or a 25-hour week. And the output would be the same per capita output that we had in 1950, which was certainly manageable for society. If we distributed it fairly, it would be more, everybody would be better off except the, right? This is pretty interesting. Who the hell's making this decision? The answer is nobody, right? We'll figure that out in the other class. This is a decision that is an outgrowth of the logic of the workings of the institutions. Nobody's explicitly making this decision. Just like men don't explicitly decide all the things that are in their interest. A lot of those things that happen are just a function of those institutional structures. And the same thing with whites. Not every white sort of decides to create the conditions of racism or anything like that. Or even the whole white race, right, explicitly doesn't do it often. It happens structurally. Okay.
I had a question that backs up perhaps a little bit. You talk about how the normal workings in one sphere, when it comes to conflict, the normal workings of another upsets things.
And the example
you gave was the African Americans coming back from World War II. But their expectations were raised by not a normal working, at least what was not up until 1940 a normal working.
Birth control.
Of the institution, of the army.
Switch to birth control.
Now
it's the normal workings of the economy throwing up a new technology that makes mincemeat out of.
Right. So it's technology. I mean, the question
could
is.
Could be anything.
What is it that changes the normal workings in one sphere without changing
the
other?
See, one of the things that makes this vague is you can't answer questions like that. It's not like physics. It isn't always the same. Right? What we can do is we can get a broad conceptual framework which alerts us to what to look for and what to think about. Right?
So it's
but there is no single answer.
So it's happenstance that you just...
Well, it depends on the country and the history and the circumstances and everything else. It's a lot... For those who know physics, it's like initial conditions, which are random. You know, in other words, it's historical, right? It depends, right? But we know what attributes it will have, what characteristic flavor it will have, these things coming into conflict and their logic, right? And then getting back in line. And it tells us something profound about what we want to do, because it tells us about our need to affect more than one rather than just one. If what? If they're co-reproducing. So let's go back to that for a minute. So these spheres can be just accommodating, or they can be co-reproducing. If they're just accommodating, right? I don't know whether just is the right word, but if they're accommodating, meaning each sphere's logic isn't countering the others, and we change one of them, you know, is it clear? Accommodating, the sphere's accommodating is sort of like the economy doesn't pay men more than women, it doesn't pay blacks more than whites, if we have a racist hierarchy with whites above blacks and a gender hierarchy with women above men. The familial or socialization and so on doesn't get people ready to be something other than workers. Gets people ready in a way that's consistent with being a worker. You change the educational system if it's over-educating, the example I gave, right? And so on. So it's accommodating. But if it's accommodating, you could imagine somebody coming along and saying, look, I don't give a shit about anything else. I just want to get rid of the basic defining institutions in a particular sphere, and I'm going to focus on that. And they might do it, and they could succeed. Why could they succeed? Even without controversy. Because the other spheres aren't reproducing the ill they're trying to get rid of. See what I'm saying? If all that's happening, if all the economy is doing is accommodating, and all the polity is doing is accommodating, and all the the kinship sphere is doing is accommodating the racial hierarchy, and you work really damn hard to overthrow the racial hierarchy, and you do, right? Then they'll stop accommodating the old racial hierarchy, and they'll start accommodating the new racial hierarchy, but they won't reproduce the old one. See what I'm saying? If, on the other hand, they are co-reproducing racism, and you overthrow that racial hierarchy, you still got racism being reproduced over here in the economy and the polity and the kinship sphere. So now you've got a strange strategy. Your strategy isn't all that good, because you're missing a lot of the point. So the real question to ask about a society, if you want to approach it this way, is to ask whether the particular sphere that's your agenda, that you're concerned about, is co-reproducing with the other stuff, or whether it's just being accommodated. Because that's going to determine whether or not you can try and change just it or all the others. That's if that's your agenda. You might have an agenda of changing them all just because you are concerned about all kinds of oppression, but you might not. In the night, yeah?
That would explain why if in one culture you do something, make a change, and it causes stress, change across society, mm-hmm. It doesn't always, I mean, people can try to apply it to another culture and it doesn't work.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, for instance, in the West, the invention of printing, gunpowder, the ballistics, the whole thing, had radical impacts on weaponry, development of weapon printing, leading to the Renaissance, Reformation, the individual
so many things happen as a result of that technology because of other things.
I don't know whether it was entirely a result of that technology, but those things did happen.
But
yeah.
There were other things in the culture that fed it, but the same sort of things in China and other places that
didn't have
the same impact.
Yeah.
Or
it's very possible that that history as we know it is a pure accident. Right, that in fact the much higher likelihood was that the pharaonic system, the thing I saw in Egypt, would last forever. Or that something like that would, right? But or nearly forever, you know, or it would take a long whatever, I don't know. Who knows? But what I am concerned, it's like questions of what's the origin of X? What's the origin of racism? What's the origin of sexism? They're sort of interesting questions to talk about at 3 o'clock in the morning in the dorm. But unless they bear on what do you do now, I don't personally give a fuck, right? I care about what you do now and how you win. I'm not criticizing you. I'm just saying. So, what we want to understand is what the implications are for the actions that we take. We're most concerned about the guidance part of theory, at least when we have our revolutionary hat on, right? But when we have our explanation hat on, we're concerned about this. But you're right.
What's getting at is you do this and it works for this culture. We make this change. We do this. And we work for change, but within another culture,
it might be different.
You're not going to be able to export that. Just over.
Let me give you an example of a situation that's, I think, related to what you're saying. In China, in the revolutionary movement, they had a practice called criticism, self-criticism. Now, everything that I've been able to read about this, which may be malarkey, but everything I've been able to read about this is that it was very effective and powerful. And sometimes it was abused, and it was disgusting. But in the early stages and in the process where things were really moving along, it was good. And the idea of it was that people, you know, you can't make progress if you don't discover problems. And the idea is to get up and look at your involvement in the movement and to criticize it, and to have others criticize it and to self-criticize it. Now, sometimes it was like Stalin shows trials. But you take that idea and you drop it in the United States in the 1960s. And in our culture, it called itself criticism, self-criticism, but what it became was, you know, smash and be smashed, right? Because that's the world we live in here. It's a very aggressive, individualistic, antisocial world. And criticism, self-criticism became this vicious dynamic, and it was not suited to this culture. So that's an example of how you can imagine a tactic or a choice or an innovation which has different implications in different contexts. Same thing of, you know, a culture inside of with a different economy is going to be very different. Yeah.
But when you're talking about history, wouldn't the key then be if whatever the change is, it's like a lever that gets people to look at those relationships in a different way?
Yeah. From our point of view, if something happens, it's important, right? In other words, what's important? What do I care about when I read the newspaper each day? What's important is, you know, partly just whether people are being hurt or less hurt, you know, suffering or suffering less, because I care, because I have empathy, right? But what's important in terms of social change is some phenomenon causing the constituencies that I believe are going to be active in creating social change to become that other engine of change, right? A constituency seeking change. So something affecting the way they're viewing the world, the way they're viewing their relationships to others, and their willingness to fight to change things. Yeah, exactly. The Marxism is the most developed version of this. That's what the Marxist is doing when they say, pay attention to class struggle. Understand everything in terms of class struggle. Understand everything in terms of class struggle. If the thing causes the working class to congeal more understanding of its situation, and in particular, more militance and more willingness to fight for change, it's good. If it doesn't, it's bad. Right? In other words, everything is understood through that lens. Now, we, I think, or I hope, I understand the world, and that is part of my view. Right? But another part of my view is around race and gender and political constituencies and so on. But exactly so. I care about those phenomena in the world which are likely to cause those constituencies to see the world in different ways and to become potentially leftist, potentially active, and potentially involved, whether conscious or unconscious even. And then eventually conscious, because I want that, for the reasons that we gave when we talked about, you know, having theory in the hands of everybody. Okay. Notice none of this is very hard, I don't think. I mean, it's a little quick what we're doing, but there's no big words, there's no complications, it doesn't depend on anything very major at all. I think the hard thing is to use it. The hard thing is to be disciplined about using it and to not fall back into habits that are different, that are just, you know, just a product of daily life or a product of your own personal pains, which are important, but they're just your own personal pains. That's a fact. And they might not represent the whole, right? Which is why sometimes viewing the world from your position is not always the best thing. You have to view it from more than just one single narrow position. You want to continue?
So wouldn't the key then be people's understanding of things that are important to them, and depending on the history of that particular country, is going to be different things in different countries. So you need to understand the history of that country and the key levers. And a capitalist country where race doesn't play that role, then you're going to have different dynamics.
Then one where it does, sure.
And then if something happens in that particular sphere, it can bring about a chain of events that can change that country.
Yeah. So if somebody says to me, I want you to think about Romania, I don't know anything about Romania, right? Nothing at all. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go in and I'm going to say to myself, okay, let me look around, let me try and understand what are the basic kinship characteristics, what are the basic community characteristics, what are the basic political characteristics, what are the basic economic characteristics, not one or the other, but all of them. I'm going to try and see, are these spheres just sitting here, or are they accommodating each other, or are they co-reproducing each other? Are the constituencies that these spheres define conscious, self-conscious, in what way? They're conscious, but in what ways are they conscious? What kinds of consciousness do they have? How aroused are they about their circumstances, etc.? That's the kind of stuff I'm going to try and understand. I'll also try and understand, you know, is it in the Dark Ages or the Modern Ages in terms of development? Or, you know, does it have a big ocean port or whatever? You know, all those things, but those are peripheral, right? What matters is this: what's first order, you might say. The other stuff matters, but it's second and third order. What's first order is these structural questions about the institutions. I'm going to try and understand. Now, is this a whole theory, by the way? Of course not. What we're missing is enriching our understanding, our conceptual toolbox for gender, for race, and community more broadly, for the polity, and for the economy. In the economics courses, I'll try and do it for the economy. But we need to do it for all four. Right? So we need to have this broad framework, but then we need to have more pointed concepts, like the ones we listed at first, but well understood, right, for each of the spheres, so that we can look at each of them and understand them, and understand the constituencies and how they interact. Yeah, did you? No? Anybody? Okay, so we have an idea of revolution. At least I have a particular definition of that, which is what again?
The defining institutions of one of the spheres change.
At least one, yeah. And what do we know about a society which is highly co-reproducing? What's most likely going to be the case if there's a revolution?
It's going to more than all the spheres.
Yeah, in a society there where they're really highly co-reproducing. We're going to expect that any revolution that I should be clear about something. Any revolution that is liberatory, that really liberates, right, one of the spheres will probably liberate all four because they're so reproducing. You might get a revolution which doesn't get all the way. You might go from apartheid to racism, or you might go from, the Soviet-style economy to the capitalist economy without revolutionizing everything. But if you really get rid of the hierarchies, right, then you probably, see what I'm saying? Yeah.
I'm confused again and again about why being orthodox about one of these revolutionary theories
is a bad idea.
Yeah, because what I seem to understand before is that if you do have these spheres that are co-reproducing and you're focusing on changing the kinship relationship and you do overthrow that, then you still have this residual effect with
unless you've overthrown them too.
Right, but
that's why if they're really co-reproducing, you anticipate that if you really, really succeed with one of them, it's because you probably really succeeded with all of them. It takes time. Suppose the process really is in history. There's reasons why I don't think it'll be this, which we'll get to when we talk about strategy in the next thing. But suppose it was this. Suppose a gigantic labor movement erupts in the United States. Just like that, right? So all of a sudden tomorrow we've got this gigantic militant labor movement. And it's really... it's gone berserk, right? It takes over the factories, right? And it even has a participatory economic, you know, it's really going to revolutionize the economy, really revolutionize the economy. But there's no movement around gender. There's no movement around race. There's no movement around the state. If it's the case that these other things are really reproducing the old class hierarchies, meaning, and we'll do this in the economic, meaning the assumptions that people have about other people due to their classes, meaning the fact that if you're walking down the street and you're working class, you expect, and you see somebody working toward you, you can tell whether they're an intellectual class or a worker. And if they're the former, you know they expect you to step aside rather than them. Right? All sorts of stuff. Right? That's built into people's expectations and behaviors. And it's a shock when it doesn't happen. Right? All sorts of things like that. It's called the hidden injuries of class by some very good writers. Or race, or gender. Right? It's the kind of stuff that women taught when they uncovered sexism, or blacks taught when they uncovered racism in the United States in fundamental ways, and they taught that it affects how people talk and how people interact and how people move and and everything, right? So it isn't even just how men relate to women; it's how men are, right? And it's fucked up, or how whites are, and it's fucked up. The white culture isn't just bad because it's racist; it's bad because it's just screwed up, right? Because of rationalizing racism and so on and so forth. So you keep all that shit, right? And you change the economy. What do you expect? War. You expect that there's tremendous conflict. And what happens? Either it goes back or everything else changes. Now, you could argue, and this could resurrect the single-issue approach, you could argue that it's still the case, says the Marxist, that the best route to changing everything is to change the economy and fight the battle and change the rest. It's just that we should do the economy first. Now you have a more sophisticated Marxist, right? History might prove the person right. I don't think so, right? The reason I don't think so is because women aren't, you're not going to overthrow the economy blind to sex. Because if you're blind to gender, your labor movement is going to be a fucking mess. Because it's going to be internally coming apart. And the same thing around race. So the problem, and that's why, because they're so strong in our society, right, that you can't win one because you can't muster the force to win one. Because of the internal divisions that come about because of the pains people feel when the other things aren't addressed. That's the real strategic reason why it manifests. But that's true because these things exist and they divide us into these groups and they give us these expectations and desires. And the minute you begin to address liberation, so the anti-war movement begins to talk about liberation in 1969 and 68, immediately, you know, it's a realm in which even if it isn't as more sexist than society, the sexism hurts more than it does in society. And so the resistance comes along, and you immediately have, you know, the women's movement and the internal conflict. And you either relate to it or you have a war and you don't win, you know, end the Vietnam War. Because you're just fighting each other, right? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah?
Would you say the anti-globalization movement is actually beginning to make these spheres blur? So I just went to the International Forum on Globalization in Washington, and they had panels of speakers on them from representing all of these different spheres, entering it all into, like, one...
That's good. That's good. That's a good sign, and it's a good possibility. In 1969, where I was, we had a rule you had to talk about the totality of oppression. If I went out and gave a speech about Vietnam, I talked about gender, race, and capital. I talked about power, and I talked about Vietnam. There weren't many places this was true, but we had this rule. You had to talk about a totality. Now it's coming. People are beginning to understand some of this stuff, right? And it's almost impossible not to understand this stuff because the constituencies force you to understand it. So we didn't start out doing that. Rather, Bread and Roses, a women's movement, came to a meeting with about 200 people planning a big anti-war demonstration in Boston, marched into the room, told everybody to sit down, surrounded the front of the room, and said, you're not going to meet until you meet these demands. Right? And the demands included talking about gender in every speech, having half women in all leadership positions, and on and on and on. Well, that was the end of that. Right, that was you know, the movement was changed. Did everything change completely perfectly? Did everybody become a wonderful soul? No, but a lot happened, right? And it happened because they just said, "You do this or else." That's the way change happens. But, you know, it takes pressure, and that's what the black movement said to the white movement, right? And those lessons were partly learned. But just as a sidebar again about. If you go from the 60s to now, I'll talk about this more later, so I won't talk about it now, but it's my pet thing, I suppose. I spent a lot of time in the late 60s, early 70s, talking about the need to pay attention to race and gender, precisely because Marxism was in the saddle, and everybody was talking about class. And I felt you needed to talk about everything for the reasons that I described. Not as well developed then, but I still felt it then. But the race argument won, and the gender argument won. And so people on the left understand to a large extent that you have to pay attention to those things. The remarkable thing is that the class argument disappeared. So that people don't understand that you have to pay attention to class. So people understand that you pay attention to the, what we'll call the hidden injuries of race. You don't have racism in your movement. You don't have racist structures in your movement. You don't have sexist structures in your movement. If you're forming an alternative media organization, right, you don't form it with you know, blacks doing the shit work or women doing the nurturing, right? And even if you want that, you don't do it. You certainly can't get up and say you want it, right? Right? You just can't get up and say. I think it would be really efficient if we had all the people who are darker loading the packages, and we'll have the white people making the decisions. And that would be efficient. You can't do that. But you can get up and say right now in front of 1,000 political left people that I think it makes sense for us to try and learn something from corporate organization about the way we make our decision making inside our institution. And the reason you can say that is because most left institutions mirror time if you look at them closely. The class argument hasn't even been addressed yet. And that has to do with the problem of Marxism, I think, which we'll talk about more. It's because all the noise about class in the late 60s was just that, noise. It wasn't real, I don't think. The other stuff was real, but that stuff wasn't very real. And the reason it wasn't very real is it was coming from middle-class people, meaning people who wanted to be managers, people who wanted to be doctors and lawyers, right? Who had no inkling of challenging that desire in themselves or that class. And so it was the words were used, working class rule. But what working class rule really meant was rule by me, right? And where I was going to be a lawyer or a doctor, right? Or a professor. It didn't mean work, you see what I'm saying? All right, anyway. Yeah. A little louder.
During that sort of approach, you part of that thing is to tackle racism at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and sexism, saying that it's not in any of our interests to be racist, it's not in any of our interests to be sexist, and then so unite into that sort of sense, and then tackle the economy.
It's better than if you don't.
Would that not?
No, it's better than if you don't. It's better than if you don't, but it's false, and it won't last. Because under pressure, you'll jettison it, right? Because it's not real deep. It's just tactical. It's just strategic. It isn't really, it's just, well, okay, we gotta have the darkies on our side, so we'll talk about not oppressing the darkies, right? That's about what it is. I honestly think, now, I'm not saying it's that for each individual. I'm not saying that, right? But structurally, it's that for the mindset. Because when the push comes to shove and there's a conflict between race and class or race and income, it disappears. Affirmative action, all of a sudden, well, maybe we're not for that because it irritates some of our white constituency and so on and so forth. So those are the problems that arise. But mostly, it never understands the full dynamic. What it does is it understands the economic part of race or the economic part of gender, right? But it doesn't get to the richer part. Now, I'm not saying that there won't be labor movements or that there shouldn't be. There will be. Right? And those labor movements will often include people in them and be moving whose eyes are narrowly set to the economy, or gender movements narrowly set to feminism. Right? I'm all for that. It will happen. Why? Because these constituencies exist, and the bottom constituencies are oppressed in a manner that makes them sensitive about that. And the particular historical circumstances that given institution, given people follow, will make lots of people have that as an agenda. Right, so these movements will come into existence. They will. You can't. There's no point talking about them not coming into existence. They will come into existence. And the question becomes: how do you create a big movement, right, which somehow gains the benefits of all of these for changing society? One answer would be: you tell everybody unite and fight, and unite and fight around class, unite and fight around gender. It ain't going to work. It isn't going to work because nobody's going to listen, right? Except the people who already agree with you. But no woman who doesn't trust the Marxist movement is going to listen, I think, rightly. But whether rightly or wrongly doesn't matter. It won't happen, right? The Native American community in the United States, there is zero chance from now until the year 9,000 they're not going to be Marxist. You can talk about how much you care about them, the Marx. It doesn't matter. Why? Because they see Marxism as the biggest threat on the planet. Why is that? And that's true for many blacks, especially in the United States. Why? What's the Marxist goal for culture?
One culture.
Socialist culture, one culture. Well, if there's one culture, whose culture is it going to be? You think it's going to be, you know, the Navajo's culture in the United States? Right? Is it going to be black culture in the United States? Latino culture in the United States? No. What we know, what they say, what do they say about whose culture it's going to be? It's going to be the working class's culture. So arguably, it should be everybody should be happy, right? Because it's the working class's culture. There's a slight problem here, right? Which one is that? Which religion is that? Which culture is that? Which community is that? Which, you know, none. It's all of them, right? So it doesn't mean anything. So what culture is it really going to be? Well, it's really going to be the culture of the people who run the new society. And all we got to do is look at history to see who that's going to be if this manner, if this approach works. Because it's happened many times. Right? And so you get Soviet culture. The Soviet states, you know, that community's culture imposed on everybody. And when the lid comes off, right, what was supposed to happen is that everybody is, let's have one good culture, right? But when the lid comes off, you discover that they're all berserk. They're ready to kill each other. And once the lid is off, they're all fighting culturally again. Because nothing was really solved. I don't know whether people know what I'm talking about here even. But nothing was solved by this cultural homogenization. Because people have their identities, right? It was just submerged, and then it burst forth.
What you're suggesting is that a truly good social movement would be one that tackled all four spheres at once. It seems that it would have even more problems getting people involved with it because it prevents people from living their lives while the movement's going on. Could you dismantle the economy, the polity, the family, and every institution? Where do people exist while institutions are being transformed?
That's not, I think that we'll see that's not a real problem as we go along. Because you don't dismantle anything. Nothing ever gets dismantled. And certainly not overnight. That's not the way history works, right? So, but what you're saying is that there's a struggle in all these realms. Well, there is a struggle in all these realms.
But at least on a comfort level, the knowledge that you can transform, say, the family, and at least know that you will be able to exist.
And the only person who's going to be comfortable by the idea that the family isn't being addressed is the person who sees the family as in their interest now. And once people are conscious, that will not be women, I don't think. Unless I'm wrong, in which case, fine, that won't be a target, right? But you see what I'm saying?
Right.
You're right. Look, if we don't address the economy, there's a certain sector of people who will be comforted by the fact that the movement doesn't address the economy. But it ain't working people. It's people who benefit from the economy. Same thing goes in the cultural sphere. If we don't attach community, yeah, it's less disruptive to white folks in the U.S. Makes things easier. Less to worry about, less challenge, less everything. That's absolutely true. Also, less progress, because we won't win. We're going to deal a lot with this as we go along. But I'm not saying, be clear, I'm not saying a priori that I know that in every society you should have a four-headed movement. What am I saying? I'm saying that in every society where you have the four spheres all defining social life and all co-reproducing, you should have a four-headed movement. Right, but if that's not the case, then you shouldn't. Yeah?
Do they have to occur simultaneously? I think
that's you know what simultaneous is in history?
Well, right, of course, it's not. Right.
Right?
It's, you know,
that's what I mean. It's not. Don't get into the mindset like physics or math or something like that, where a word simultaneous means. You see what I'm saying? It's a long process, and stuff starts and there's unequal development and et cetera, et cetera. But yes, I think that they're all happening. But there's not. I don't have to ask for that. That's the way it is. You see what I'm saying? What we do have to ask is whether or not we need a framework which admits that that's the way it is and takes into account that's the way it is and helps people to deal with the fact that that's the way it is and to see what they're doing in terms of what other people are doing. Let me give you one sentence of three. Is that right? Suppose the anti-war movement in the 1960s had the mindset I'm talking about and the civil rights movement comes along. Right? Or actually, the civil rights movement actually was there, but then the anti-war movement becomes vast, right? And in becoming vast, it has huge resources at its disposal. This is just fact. There's lots of money donated to the anti-war movement. There's lots of resources at its disposal. Because of its constituency, it has accesses to a lot of the nooks and crannies. You know, it can get at the machines and so on. So it can get information out, and it can do various things. And then there's the civil rights movement at the same time. What should the anti-war movement have seen as its approach to the civil rights movement? You can imagine various possibilities. Go ahead.
But I have a question.
Before we answer that one, okay.
But it's directly related.
Yeah.
most of the activists came out of the civil rights movement in particular, and then if you look at the white women's movement, many of the leaders were trained by Ella Baker, but that consciousness didn't transfer over.
Well, there was some of that. I wouldn't go overboard on the number. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of people in these other movements, but it's true, certainly, that, you know, like Tom Hayden was in the South, one of the central leaders in SDS. And a lot of the people who were in SDS were in the South. But you can go and you can fight around race and not really pick it all up. I mean, if that's your question, of course that can happen. Or you can pick it up for a time and then lose it.
But I'm saying, you're saying what should have happened, and I'm saying that since they came out of the civil rights movement, many of the leaders, that conscious, you know, you're saying what should have happened, but I'm saying they were involved in the civil rights movement, so they were confronting racism. And then from there, they went on to the Vietnam War, and then the whole ecological movement, well, the whole peace movement, acts as if it was a white movement, as well as understand that it came out, I mean, the civil rights movement had that component.
Right.
In it.
Well,
and all of a sudden, it's forgotten.
Well, it's partly forgotten. The anti-war movement grew dramatically. And there were many people, including involved in leadership and everything else, who didn't have that background. But the key thing, what would a Marxist say is the key thing? Or... did anybody see the movie the one about the Watergate? Was it Watergate? Yeah. What are you supposed to do?
Follow the President's Men.
Huh?
Follow the President's Men.
Yeah, what are you supposed to do to find the...
Follow the money.
Follow the money. The anti-war movement all of a sudden was getting a whole lot of money, and the money was coming from white liberals, right? And that had a tremendous... impact on the scope and the politics of the movement. It always has had. Never been a discussion. It's remarkable. I bet nobody in here knows where the money comes from for everything that they relate to. And no Marxist ever knows that. That is what it tells you. It's just there's an element of bullshit in some of this stuff, right? If you're a Marxist and you think that economics is everything, you'd think you'd know the economics of your own institutions, right? The magazine Socialist Revolution, which was a magazine for 20 years, it came into existence, it went out of existence. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. What's the name of the damn thing? Democracy was the name of the magazine. Comes into existence, goes out of existence a period of 4 or 5 years. Somebody writes the Socialist Revolution, does a history of it, which was unusual. Leftists in the United States rarely look at their own projects and their own and trying to understand what the history and what the lessons are. But this guy tried to do it. And he's a Marxist. So he wrote about the whole thing. There was a lot of interesting stuff. But there was one thing missing. The thing came into existence the way on the day a particular person decided to fund it and to hand over a gigantic check. And the thing went out of existence on the day that that person decided to withhold the money. It wasn't even in the story. Nothing about the money was in the story. Right? And there's no Marxist writing about it. That's a little sidebar story, but it tells you something. But anyway, part of the problem was that. But my question was what should it have done, regardless of why it didn't do it? Suppose the anti-war movement had said to the civil rights movement, you know, it turns out that because this country is a racist shitbox, we have access to a gigantic amount of resources, and you have access to almost none. So here's the deal. Take this. No questions asked, no issues, right? We know that we have it because we're white. You can have it. By the way, if you want us to turn out our people, just tell us where and when. If that had been done in 1969, as best people could have done it, which wasn't perfect, the world would be a different place right now, I honestly believe. I'm not saying we would have won everything, but it would be profoundly different. But it wasn't done. And when you describe, somebody described the globalization situation, to the extent that it does that, and it's not doing that yet fully, if the globalization movement said to the anti-Mumia movement, I mean to the free Mumia movement, we've got way more than you do. Right? Where do we have to turn out? What do you want us to do? What do we do on the day that, you know, and here's some resources. That would have powerful impact. As a message to the black community that your distrust of whitey may be not as warranted as it was yesterday, because it would still be warranted. Powerfully warranted. But why are we white? You know, overwhelmingly white here. Why is the readership of Z overwhelmingly white? Why is that because the black community isn't as political? No, the black community is more political than the white community. Right? It's partly because the pressures and the time and everything else make ideological activity harder, and so less people have time for it. But it's largely distrust of white activists, white leftists, warranted by a couple hundred years of betrayals. So that would have had a big effect. Now, a consciousness which says unite and fight around class is never going to get to this. Because it's never going to say, you know, no questions asked, no issues, no nothing, it hurts us, who gives a shit? Here's the resources. Right? We're going to break this down. We're really going to break this down finally. It's different. You see what I'm saying? Aside from, it would help to understand. It would help that it isn't white guilt, but it's real understanding. Because right? If it's white guilt, they probably won't even take it. Right? Some won't, anyway. Some will. Rightly. I mean, people should take it. I think, I mean, you know, if it's white guilt, who gives a shit what it is? Just take it. But some won't. Wrongly.